This is Alan Shapiro with Cider Summit, and you're listening to Cider Chat.
Episode 75.
Going up, going up, 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 up.
To cider, 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 cider,
cider, cider, cider. Hello and welcome to Cider Chat. My name is Rhea Wincaller, and I am the producer and cider MC of this weekly podcast where we speak with makers, enthusiasts, and folks within the cider trade from around the world. And this week, we're chatting with Alan Shapiro, the man behind the festival called Cider Summits. There'll be more on that chat in just a moment. There's a cider swag contest happening right now for a t-shirt from Forgotten Ciders, who was on last week's episode number 74, and that was Nicole and Rafe Ward. That's an amazing orchard-based cidery in Michigan, and they provided two lovely t-shirts, which has their logo in front, which is a big apple with three bottles of cider, and then on the back, it has their slogan, "The harder, the better." So it's a very fun t-shirt, and all you need to do to enter is to take a screenshot of your laptop or phone while you're listening to Cider Chat. Better yet, if somebody takes a photo of you and you upload it and you tag Cider Chat, you could do it via Twitter and just tag at Cider Chat, Instagram, just tag Cider Chat Ciderville, or post it to the Cider Chat Facebook page. And you have a really good chance of entering because, well, let's see, this is going live on Wednesday, the 12th of April, and the contest ends on the 14th. If you are a patron of Cider Chat via the Cider Chat Patreon page, you're automatically entered, so you folks are covered. But there's just been a couple folks who have taken the time to post that screenshot when you're listening to the podcast. So why not try it? Not only do you help kind of promote this podcast out to the world, you also get a chance to win this really super nice t-shirt. If you want to get more details, just go to the ciderchat.com website and go to the Cider Swag page. Well, it's time to welcome and give a hi, howdy doody to the folks who have joined the Cider Chat Facebook page. And once again, it's an amazing group of people, a cross-section of the universe of Ciderville. People doing some really neat stuff. So let's start with this person who's in the quality food and beverage internationally, and welcome Garun. And then we have Zach, who then posted a little bit of a message asking me about a technique. It's kind of considered like a winemaking technique. It's called batonnage, and it's where you keep the lees, which is like another word I call it, is a schmutz on the bottom of like a carboy, right? And you stir it up with the goal of kind of increasing the body and mouthfeel of the final product. So I posted that on the Cider Chat Facebook page, and there's been some interesting chatter there, a little bit about that and some malolactic fermentation. And Zach wrote a little bit more about what he's doing, and Mike did too. So I'm going to keep that up there and not really address it. And if you want to take a peek at that now that you know that that conversation is going, and if this is something that you do or you have an interest about, kind of keep on posting it, and I'll see if I could get to it next week to kind of put my own two cents on that. And I just really appreciate Zach taking the time to write about that. So we also want to welcome Cheryl, who is from New England, I think my home state too, Massachusetts. And then we have Ryan from another home state of mine, California. I do believe, Ryan, you're doing some probably fermenting out there. Then we have, I'm going to say his full name here, it's Matisse Narwold, and he is from Chile and works with his cousin Diego Rivera, who was on episode 40. If you haven't listened to that chat, that is the cidery called Quebrada del Chicagua. That was a fantastic chat, learning about Chile. And wouldn't you know it, some people heard that and they actually went down to Chile. So, man, this world of Ciderville is just busting loose. And then we have Miguel from Asterias in Gijón. That's where I was last September, recording all those amazing amazing chats with cider makers from all over Europe and also Asturias. So welcome, Miguel. You live in a hot spot for cider, definitely. Then we have someone called Boranala. Welcome to Cider Chat, by all means. Then we have Suzanne. Suzanne, you're a local yokel in my neighborhood, so welcome. And then we have David, who is connected to Virtue. And of course, Virtue is a cidery in Michigan. And I had the cider maker on this chat. That's episode 22. That's Gregory Hall. So if you want to hear about that scene there, Virtue's making some really nice stuff straight out there. You know, Greg was involved with Goose Island. He and his dad were part of that, and he was doing a lot of the brewing. Then he went over and started Virtue. It's a pretty interesting story, and that was a nice chat. Then we have Christine from Ohio, and you know, I had a little mini chat directly with you, Christine, but what I think I remember seeing you post somewhere else is that you just found out about Cider Chat. And that's one of the reasons why I really believe like kind of promoting this podcast, because there's a lot of people that don't know that it exists. I mean, this is the only cider podcast out there in the world, and we want to keep cider going up. We want to educate people. That's what Alan's going to be talking about. That's why we have Cider Fest, or in this case, the Cider Summit. So welcome, Christine. I'm really, really psyched that you've gotten to know a little bit about the podcast, and you're finding it worthwhile. We also have Garrett, who is from Michigan, too. Of course, last week's chat was from a Michigan cidery at Forgotten Ciders. And then Johan from the Netherlands. And Johan works at De Verken Appel. And that's actually, I think, like the Forgotten Apple. My Dutch, I'm not in the swing of it quite right. And let me see, I'm going to try that one more time. De Verken Appel. The V is typically like pronounced like a F, so it's like the Forgotten Apple is kind of how you would say that. And that's based in Tilburg, which is in the southern region of the Netherlands. So it's probably about 2 hours south of Amsterdam. And what I like about this cidery, I believe, is that there's a Facebook page, so you could check that out. And I'm make a note here to put that in the show notes so you could kind of link to that, the Forgotten Apple. And it says, always open. That's pretty cool, Johan. And thank you for connecting. I work down in that region once every fall, so maybe we could connect. And then we have Steve from Indiana. And then we have Jonathan. So welcome to that massively awesome group of people. And do know that this is not an exclusive page. You could join in on the conversation too. Just Google Cider Chat Facebook and we'll see you there. Well, it's time that we go to our main chat with Alan Shapiro, and a little bit of a background on that story. This was pre-recorded at CiderCon in February, which was held in Chicago. And at the end of CiderCon, there was the Cider Summit, and that's the events that Alan Shapiro puts on with his amazing team. And I was really curious of this story because in many ways, what he's doing and other folks who are doing cider festivals around the U.S. and the world, they're like pioneers right now on a number of levels. You know, it's kind of a risk when you start a festival and you don't really know if people are going to show up. And it's, I can't imagine, but I know it's like a huge outpouring of money up front. And in that same kind of parallel universe that you see for other libations as they're kind of coming along, specifically the craft beer in this case, and we talk a lot about the parallels of the same story in terms of the marketing, how it developed, and how you got geeks into it, and then that really, in turn, helped promote craft beer. Alan saw that same thing going on. So he's going to be talking about that story, how he got into starting the Cider Summit, and also what you could expect when you go to a festival. I was really impressed when I attended the Chicago Cider Summit. It was held at the Navy Pier. It's an indoor event. All the other events are outdoors at the other four cities, which is in San Francisco, Portland, and Seattle. And there's also a fifth location coming up, but I'm kind of hold the horses right now until Alan confirms that. But that's really, really, really exciting. Ooh, I want to tell you, but I can't. But I'll let you know as soon as I know. Alan's probably like, nails on chalkboard right now. But anyways, what's cool about it is that the guy is just, he knows how to put on a festival, not just for the attendees, but he kind of starts the whole wave of anticipation going. I arrived early. I actually did a bunch of recordings there. That was episode, let me see if I have that here, it was called Cider Enthusiast, and that was episode number, it's called Hello Chicago, Chats with Cider Enthusiasts, episode 68. It was just a fantastic time for me to walk around and do these live recordings with attendees. And I felt kind of like the cider buzz in the air, the camaraderie, the jovial feeling that happens in Ciderville. And I really attribute that to Alan and his team. Because the way he started, I've never actually seen this take place at any other Cider Fest up to this point. But he went up to the podium, and I have a nice photo of this where he's kind of talking to everybody. He called everyone over to the stage area and poured out cider in the glass for everyone. And we were drinking Aspal, which is, there's the little story about that. That's a UK cider. And had everyone raise a glass to kind of like cheers and start the day, to go forward to like a successful day. And that tells you a lot about a person, somebody who takes the time to kind of connect people. And that's the kind of person that you want leading festivals. You know, there's just no doubt about that. You want that interconnectedness. So I was super impressed, and I really delighted and be able to sit down and just kind of chatting with him and getting to know more about his background story and learning about Cider Summit. So let's now grab all our glasses out there in Ciderville, wherever you are, to sit back and enjoy this chat with Alan Shapiro of Cider Summit. You're the dude who's like setting up these amazing cider fests all over the U.S. How did you get into cider?
Well, thanks very much for inviting me. I've been listening for a while, so looking forward to the day when we were going to meet and have the chance to visit. I was really more specialty beer background through much of my career. And in 2002, I decided to start my own specialty beer importing company. I had been doing that for another Seattle-based company for the previous several years. And as I was getting ready to travel to Europe, to kind of doing my first buying trip, I guess I would call it, I heard from an old industry colleague who was representing a company called Foods from Britain, who was a marketing agent effectively representing British goods from Bass Ale or Walker Shortbread or any of those kinds of things, and mentioned to me that there was a family cidery in Suffolk that was interested in coming to the U.S. I politely declined, saying I wasn't the least bit interested in cider. I had sold wine coolers very early in my career with Seagram's in the late 80s, and that was my depth of knowledge of cider at the time. They were the same thing.
Oh, no.
And he said, no, you really should take a look at this. This is more interesting. So I agreed to let him send me a bottle, and I thought, all right, I'm going to be in the neighborhood, so I'll pay them a courtesy visit. So that was, think about July of 2002, and I arrived at Aspel in Suffolk, England, at this stunning 300-acre orchard estate that dates back to, you know, something like 1100. Mm-hmm. And the family had been making cider there since 1728, met the brothers Barry and Henry, and for the first time in my life tasted real cider. Mm-hmm. Or they would say proper cider.
When you were arriving there, mm-hmm. I'm just kind of wondering what that transition was. So, you know, here you are, you accept the invitation, you go there. At what point at that visit did you realize, oh my goodness, this is not, you know, what I thought this was going to be?
was getting the courtesy tour and began to get a little intrigued as I'm looking at the orchards and seeing different apples for the first time. And then we sat on the patio outside the English manor home that literally has a small moat that runs around it, straight out of storybook. And I saw the bottle, and I'm like, oh, that's nice. And I tasted their dry, Aspel dry, and I joke that people with a good vocabulary would call it their epiphany moment. I just kind of called it my wow moment. And it was dry and elegant and champagne-like, and I instantly thought of when I had my first good glass of wine after having only sampled the jug stuff, because I'm that old, or my first good beer.
Oh, stop already. He's not that old, believe me, Simon.
I thought, wow, I've accidentally stumbled upon something here. Yeah. And this was 2002, so we were pretty early days of artisanal cider development, especially in the U.S., but I just thought it was high enough quality and unique enough that it would kind of cut through the clutter of the marketplace, mm-hmm. and it was kind of one of those better to be lucky than good moments. And so we brought Aspel to the U.S. in the spring of 2003, and I was shocked by how well it was received, and all of a sudden I became a cider guy for the first time.
Oh, wow, 2002. So, you know, relative scheme of things, not too long ago. How did you explain or introduce that to folks?
I think I took the same tact that they took with me, which was, please be open-minded about this, and you'll see it, and you'll taste it, and you will know that we're onto something here. And so, some of the more progressive retailers like a Whole Foods and also a number of, I would call, bistro-y restaurants mm-hmm. who prided themselves on having kind of eclectic mm-hmm. by the glass selections responded really well to it. And I would say also the good beer bars and brew pubs appreciated the quality of that mm-hmm. versus a number of the other things that they previously had in the category. Mm-hmm. And so they were big supporters. And it helped that I live in Seattle. And so it was a good community to start in. And so we kind of hit Washington and Oregon first.
Absolutely.
And kind of made our way across the country over the next several years. And it was an extremely pleasant surprise by how well it was received.
So you're based in Washington,
mm-hmm.
and you're in the largest producer of apples in the U.S., Washington State's number one on that level. Prior to that, did you see any cider making going on locally, or you were just full on in the craft beer scene?
It just wasn't on my radar.
Yeah,
I was on the really even. I started in the kind of the craft beer universe in about '89 and '90 in mm-hmm. the Bay Area as the first sales manager for an early craft brand called Pete's Wicked Ale.
I've never heard of that before.
Well, I don't know how many of your listeners go back that far with their craft beer selections,
right.
But
it was big. It was really, really big.
Yeah, it was Sam Adams and Pete's were kind of the two
yes.
brands that were
yeah.
on the front end from a aggressive publicity standpoint.
Absolutely.
And then I transitioned more into specialty import in about 95 with a company called Merchant de Venne, mm-hmm. which was one of the earlier imports of craft styles from around the world. So I felt that maybe I had stumbled onto the front end of a similar kind of evolution that would come as wine had progressed, through the 70s and 80s, and beer had started to progress through the late 80s mm-hmm. and 90s. And, again, the old better lucky than good kind of thing. I just landed, had a great brand and a good place to start mm-hmm. to try to, help promote this end of the cider segment.
Yeah. So that was your first import. What was the second import for cider?
There were no others. No, that was, I had a few breweries that I worked with in England and Belgium, and I just didn't think the time was right And I just had such a great relationship with Aspal.
Wow.
So we expanded their number of offerings in the U.S., but that was the only cider brand I represented until I sold my importing business in 2012.
Wow, no kidding. Wow, that's, well, you picked a good one. You know, I mean, it was pretty well known, and now you can see it across the U.S. You could, for the most part, if you're going to the right stores, you could definitely get it.
And that was the vision once upon a time, but it, you know, of course, took a while to get there.
Mm-hmm. So we're in 2017, so that's 5 years ago. So in 2012, what changed for you?
Well, so I guess I'll step back a couple years before that to kind of segue us to the festivals.
Yeah.
And in about 2007, 2008, I was back in the Bay Area visiting with an old friend from my craft beer days. And he was the co-founder of Pete's Brewing Company, a guy named Mark Bronder. And Mark, he's just, you know, he's a Silicon Valley investor type primarily. And he's one of those guys that will meet you and ask you six or eight questions about what you do. And he will understand your business, and then he will have another great six questions for you and say, this is what I think you ought to do. So he knew very little about the cider universe, so he was quizzing me about that. And he said, boy, this sure sounds a lot like kind of the late 80s and early 90s when we were trying to get craft beer going. And people didn't understand that beer could be brown or black in color, let alone what dry, what dry hop meant.
Right.
He said, so I think a big part of it back then is it seemed like every other weekend we were at some community fair and educating the consumer one by one at our little booth. And he said, you know, if I was in your shoes, I would really think seriously about starting some cider festivals to give people some sampling opportunity and unlock the mystery of what they're starting to see on the shelves and in the bars. And in another one of those kind of aha moments, I said to him, you know, Mark, when I worked for you when I was in my 20s, I really didn't think you were that bright, but, you know, now I get it. And, I sat on the idea for a couple of years until I thought it might be viable. And so finally in 2010, I partnered with some good friends of mine in Seattle, produced Seattle Beer Week, and we created our first Cider Summit in September of 2010, having no idea if anyone would show up, scrambling to even try to have 40 product offerings, because even in 2010, there weren't, you know, that many.
Not out on the West Coast.
Yeah, I mean, and we were in the home of where there would be the most options, probably, right, in the Northwest and the Northeast at the time. And but we, not knowing a whole lot about festival production, managed to slap the thing together, and 400 or 500 people showed up.
No kidding, that first one.
And, you know, again, we didn't really know what we were doing, but the feedback was very, very positive, and so that gave us the confidence or inspiration or pick your word to start expanding. So we added Portland in 2011, came to Chicago in 2013 to correspond with CiderCon coming to the city, and then we added the Bay Area in 2014. And so I believe our festival this weekend is our 21st festival that we'll be producing, and from that start of about 400 people, this one will probably be at least 3,000 people, maybe 3,500. So it's
3,500 over two sessions. So you, the festival that Alan's talking about is the Chicago Cider Summit. It's going to be taking place the day after CiderCon ends, so it's Saturday. This podcast will already that event will already have taken place by the time we go live. But you do it as two sessions. So you have that morning session, which I just love. It starts at 11 a.m. in the morning, and it goes till 3.
Right.
And then the afternoon session is from 4 to 8. Is that typically how you set up the day? Time-wise?
This is the only city where we do that.
Oh, all right.
The West Coast festivals, so Seattle, Portland, and San Francisco, our 4 days, they're typically 5 or 6 hours. And in the case of Portland and Seattle, we actually do Friday and Saturday and allow people to come back to the festival if they're so inclined. And here we discovered in our second year that traditionally the wine and beer festivals in Chicago seem to be in those shorter sessions. And, you know, candidly, we're in very expensive space for our event at Navy Pier. And so to kind of turn that room like a restaurant would makes it just viable for us. And it fits with the kind of the custom of the city. So we love being in nicer spaces for our events. And but it's a little bit more rushed, you know, in many respects. But the serious industry people and real, you know, the professionals like that earlier session before it gets a little too crazy.
21 festivals, that's amazing. So you're getting it down. What is kind of like that learning curve? What did you learn in that first festival back in Seattle?
Oh, man. The truth is, we learn something every festival, too. Sure. There's always a surprise. Our knowledge base was from having attended other people's festivals, right? But I refer to it as a 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle, you know, because you're dealing with so many different, not just cider maker vendors, but, you know, tents and tables and ticket companies and wristbands. And so we just kept learning. I will say that what helped us the most was when everyone's wives or girlfriends became part of the team, because I think...
Women, whose team?
Our production team.
Team, okay.
I think women are naturally better organizers.
We're good at multitasking.
And time doesn't allow any lengthy list of examples where, you know, we're still rubbing two sticks together to try to create fire, and then when, you know.
The girls are swooning right now. I'm loving this. Keep it going, Alan. Keep it going. You're winning us over.
We, one example is in Portland where, the guys, we in most of our states are able to have a bottles to go store. Mm. We unfortunately can't here in Chicago, but it just depends with the laws.
Bottles to go. What you're referring to is people get to go around taste. And then you have like a bottle shop on site, or
exactly.
They're not buying it directly from the vendors.
They're buying it from us dedicated kind of,
excellent.
Basically a pop-up bottle
fantastic.
Shop. And so I think one of the first times we did that in Portland with the guys running it, we never figured out how to organize the inventory, and we always had a line of, you know, 75 people.
Oh, my goodness.
And then the next year we turned it over, you know, to the wives and girlfriends to run, and we're looking at it going, boy, it sure doesn't seem very busy this year. The line's never more than five people deep. And I said, well, I think, you know, our attendance is up about 50%. So I have a feeling our sales will be, too. And, you know, sure enough, that's exactly what happened. So he said, don't you think we should jump in and help? I said, no, I think we should stay out of their way. They seem a whole lot better at this than we were. So
that's smart.
So that, you know, and then beyond that, there's always just some surprises that power going out at a city park. And
because some of your events are indoors and some are outdoors.
Chicago's our only indoor event, which,
only
of course, being here in February is kind
sense.
Of our only option. So we like kind of urban parks if possible. Mm-hmm. We like grass. We like trees. It's cider. It's orchards. And that's kind of the... But we like them. We've tried to select nicer upscale locations because we think people that are attending respond to that and they treat the whole event with a little more respect. And I think it, you know, when we're here to help both introduce people to cider, but, you know, maybe help elevate the image of it from where it was, you know, 20 years ago or something.
So for the attendee thinking about coming to a cider summit somewhere, coming to their city soon, what can they expect? They show up, they pay the price of admission, and what do you receive from that?
Right, so you'll get a souvenir glass, which is typically kind of like a mini Belgian goblet, so it's very good for nosing the cider as well, and depending on the type of ticket.
And it's a glass?
It's a glass glass. One city does not allow us to use that, but we found a really nice, hard plastic. It's fantastic. It's just not as recyclable as the other materials, unfortunately, but it's city dictated. So depending on the type of ticket they purchase, they will get tasting tokens.
Okay.
And in most cases, the tastes are 4 ounces.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes, you know, if it's high alcohol content or something like that, we do smaller portions.
Yeah.
And there is generally somewhere between 150 and 200 different ciders available from roughly 50-ish different cider companies. You know, we always publish an event guide a few days in advance, and it's available online as well.
Mm-hmm.
So my advice is to show up with a strategy and look at those things.
Like, well, what kind of strategy?
You know, so some people like to zero in on maybe trying, you know, flavored or hopped or spiced ciders. Some are very focused on local only.
Mm-hmm.
Others may have never experienced, you know, Basque or Asturian cider.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an opportunity, without buying a 750 ml of it, to, you know, to sample that and experiment. So, I mean, I encourage people to maybe go outside of their comfort zone a little bit, because that's a big part of the purpose of the event.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're, if not always, usually kind of the biggest game in town for that, you know, where you have such a wide variety of ciders.
Yes.
And so take advantage of that opportunity maybe to sample some things that you don't see at the, you know, your grocery store down the street.
Mm-hmm.
And people can buy more tasting tickets at the event for $2 each.
And you have a VIP ticketing, right, where people could come in earlier. So there's different tiers. Is that true at most of your festivals?
Yeah, there's what is included in the VIP varies just a touch, but usually it's additional tasting tickets.
Okay.
Usually it's early entry to the event,
mm-hmm.
and we limit that. So that's really, you know, if you're someone that wants to talk to cider makers,
yeah.
and talk about the apples and techniques and all that, that's really the best window.
Which is part of the fun of it, because the cider makers, a lot of them are pouring their own cider, and they're showing up because they want to have that conversation. I think that's important for people attending the summit, not to be shy to ask the questions of the cider makers, no matter what the question is, because they're more than willing to educate and to share the knowledge and get geeked out if need be, and be in the joy of the cider.
And, you know, it's so in some respects, it's kind of like going to a beer festival in 1995, where, you know, the breweries didn't have sales organizations and marketing
right.
people and all
right.
that, right? It was, and, you know, if you were in Portland, you would probably meet Kurt and Rob Widmer,
mm-hmm.
you know, or something like that.
That would be really cool.
Yeah. yeah. And so, by and large, that's still what happens at our festival. And so people, you know, and the cider makers want to make those personal connections.
They do.
And
yeah.
I think it's a cool opportunity to meet those people.
Right, right. Now, at the Chicago Summit, the ciders that you have on hand, is it a state regulation here that you're only bringing in ciders that are sold currently in Illinois? Is that correct?
Right. So, and that's the case, you know, with very, very few exceptions, anywhere we do our festivals is we have
that.
To, you know, I guess it's inside pool a little bit, but we,
sure.
you know, we purchase the product from these cider makers. They don't donate it to us. You know,
okay.
we value their time at supporting mm-hmm. the event and being there. We pay them for their product. That's not always the way festivals go.
Mm-hmm.
But we need a legal inventory transaction, which means they're licensed to do business in the state of Illinois or state
okay.
of Washington,
right,
et cetera. Right.
I was going to go to Chicago Cider Summit. I know that I'm going to be able to get both U.S. and some overseas ciders. How about if I go to San Francisco? What might I expect there? The same thing?
In the sense, each festival has a local / regional focus.
Okay.
So, you know, there's very few Michigan ciders, for example, that do business in California. So,
yet Michigan. I'm just keeping positive.
Right. So, and, you know, or
right.
Washington. Or,
right.
And similarly, the small California producers aren't here in Chicago.
Right.
So, but we feel it's important to have a good cross-section both geographically and stylistically. So there will always be some Normandy cider, there will always be some Basque cider, because
English
we want
ciders.
Right, absolutely.
Right.
So we, my heart is still with my old friends at Aspall. So they're always, you know, part of the festival. Nice. So we, as long as those products are legally distributed in those states, we want to have a good cross-section of the entire cider category, not just California ciders in San Francisco, but again, it might be two-thirds of the products are from California. In that case, a little less so in Chicago, in the sense there's obviously not as many cideries in the upper Midwest as there are in the Northwest, for example.
What about food?
That varies by event as well. So at the Chicago event this weekend, as we're speaking, we do more food sampling. So there'll be a couple different cheese sampler plates, some charcuterie sampler plates. There's some Belgian chocolates that are going to be part of it. At other events, we can... we'll have vendors on site, whether it's food trucks or them coming in and barbecuing or whatever. That all varies a little bit by city regulations and the exact venue regulations. Again, in that regard, Chicago is more the exception to the rule, where we just kind of have the sampling program. The other West Coast cities, there's some on-site food prep and a little bit more of a...
Like a, small, a food truck type of setup or something, if it could go in that
exactly.
way.
Exactly.
Right, because you see folks sometimes going to Cider Fest and they're wearing the necklace of pretzels.
Yeah.
You know, like a good preparation for showing up, just to kind of keep the water going. And food and balancing that out with cider is a great way for an attendee.
We're so lucky, I'll knock on wood, sound effect, that we have great attendees who I think are genuinely interested in why they're there. And it's not what some might refer to as a frat boy beer fest. Right, so...
do those happen?
I've heard such a thing. Right. So it's great. I mean, we just, for now on 20 events, you know, we've so rarely had problems with that. And we're thrilled as an event producer. That's one of the worst things that can happen is if you have, you know, too many consumption issues. And we love the people that come to our festivals.
So what is that makeup of the people? And have you seen a shift when you first started? We're talking, what was the year again that you started, just to do the math?
2010 is when we started in Seattle.
In Seattle. So we're looking at 7 years. Have you seen a younger drinker coming up, or is it initially that same profile of cider drinkers?
I think the core of our audience has remained roughly the same, but it's expanding now over the years. So I would say, if I had to very briefly describe who comes to the festival, it's probably couples in their early 30s. I think, say, we're very strong, say, 25, 39. You will see people in their 50s and 60s, and the first park we used in Portland was close to an assisted living facility.
Awesome.
So we sometimes had senior citizens and walkers, you know, coming. I feel terrible because we'd have these huge site plans. And a few 21 to 25 now. Yeah. But the other thing with our festival is we're very evenly divided, 50-50 male-female. And so I think that actually also contributes to good behavior.
Yes.
And
balance.
Yes. And so that's remained pretty consistent. We're primarily an urban audience, you know, but because we are typically the, if not only, or largest cider festival that happens in each of the communities, we tend to draw from an hour and a half, you know, geographic area. We had no idea when we started, but it's been exciting to just watch it mature and to see a big space like the Navy Pier Grand Ballroom, you know, filled with cider drinkers.
I'm excited to see it. I'll be attending this event in Chicago. Last year, you were at CiderCon in Portland, and you did a presentation. And that was looking at the cider market. And so can you kind of inform us a little bit about that presentation and some of the things that you've seen in terms of your work at this very specific level with cider in the U.S.?
Sure. So I guess the premise of that presentation was that now having done a lot of these festivals and obviously meeting a lot of the cider makers from around the country, they often, you know, and happily will want to chat with me about distribution or about developing their brand and their strategy. And because I've been doing this in one form or another for about 30 years now, and so kind of referencing what we spoke about earlier, I in my career lived through some evolution of the wine business and evolution of the beer business. So I thought it might be useful to kind of discuss what happened with those categories and what lessons may apply to what's still pretty early days in the cider category evolution. And what I found, right or not, is it seemed that this category was breaking into about four segments within the general cider category. So the one that kind of started, which was more of the bigger brands that people know that, you know, tend to be in six packs and have a lot of different fruit flavors and heavily advertised, kind of the, you know, the big refreshment category. Something that, you know, I called more transitional, which, and maybe craft beer influenced. So that was where, you know, made with real fruit, you know, not concentrates and all that, but probably more dessert apples, a lot of flavors, a lot of spices. Often, you know, cans are really popular now. Not that a product should be judged solely in the package that it comes in, you know, that would be unfair. But that was drawing in a lot of those consumers. Then something I think I referred to as kind of transitional artisan, that tended to be really made from cider apples, primarily drier styles, tended to be, you know, maybe 500 ml bottles, 16.9s. And then the fourth category being really more wine profile brands at higher price, 750 ml, very much from a place, you know, usually, you know, a specific family orchard or something like that. And so helping people maybe think about their brands in terms of where they sit or maybe where they want to go in the market, and then a grocery list of some of the decisions maybe they need to think about for their business, depending on who they are and where they want to
market into that profile that they want to create. I mean, it's really like creating your brand so that when people are reaching for your particular cider, they have a familiarity with it. And I think we both have seen in the craft beer, people really expect like a continuity from any brand. And it doesn't necessarily have to be that. Well, sometimes it is. You want that exact same taste in that bottle every time, which doesn't necessarily work with cider. But I think this is really informative because a lot of cidery startups don't always think about that. They're trying to like meet a lot of palates all at once versus going directly into what is their profile when people think.
Well, and
is that true?
I think that's very fair. And the decisions aren't just about what your package looks like or the size of your bottle, but it also backs into maybe how you produce a product and what kind of capital you need or what profile of distributor you maybe want to be with. And so most of us that get into this entrepreneurial thing and start up a business or whatever, we're not experts at everything. And hopefully we're smart enough to understand what we're not expert at and bring in some people. You're just scrambling, you know, in the day-to-day to get that business going and not run out of money. And and so I thought it might be useful to provide one type of template for them to think about their brands and to think about, you know, whether this category will evolve in similar ways to beer and wine and, and how they should maybe manage their individual path along that evolution or not. And again, one of those benefits of having been around for a while.
Absolutely. You need that wisdom and that, you know, being able to look back and able to look forward. So what are you seeing by looking back and looking forward? Is there a change in the way, I'm going to just again refer to U.S. cider makers, are approaching this market right now? Any type of shift, or has it been kind of continuous? You have what you said, the classic six pack that are, you know, up to like the more vintage style, like, you know, 750 mil.
I think, you know, my answer will be West Coast biased, you know, residing in Seattle and doing our events more primarily in, you know, along the West Coast states. I think the high end of the segment is emerging more slowly than maybe we thought it would 5 years ago.
Interesting. Wow. I didn't expect you to say that, but...
So
what do you think that is?
Yeah, and again, maybe this is West Coast craft beer kind of awareness, but I think consumers are being drawn in by kind of that second segment I talked about. So we know right now some of the biggest brands are starting to struggle a little bit. But most of the, you know, local and regional companies are still doing pretty well. And I think what's getting attention is new and exotic right now. And so it's the, you know, it's the rotating tap handles, you know, kind of
yes.
mentality.
Yeah.
So, and so it's, I think, going to, you know, we have so many people coming in at that level. Mm-hmm. And what do you got for me that's new? That yeah. evolution towards understanding varietals and traditional cider apples and all that is going to take longer than maybe we thought.
Right.
When I talk to some of those cider makers, you know, when I do my grandpa telling stories from the old days thing, it's...
He's not that old.
I will liken it to when I came into the Belgian beer category in about 95.
Mm-hmm.
And my company brought in a product from Lindemann's Brewery, which was a lambic, very authentic, sour, difficult to drink goose.
Yeah.
And, you know, we maybe brought in 300 cases for the United States and struggled to sell that.
Right.
Over the next 20 years, sour beer and whatnot became much more popular, and now there's like, you know, a lambic shortage.
Right. I mean, sour beers is one of the most... popular style right now.
Right. So, while...
Who would have thought, right?
So I'm not saying that a Farnham Hill Extra Dry or something is, from a taste standpoint, is anything like that, but maybe from a pricing and place in the market that there might be some parallels to draw from lambic to our highest end ciders and how long it will take people to get there. Don't know. I mean, none of us really can as we sit today, but I think if you had asked me the question, you know, 3 to 5 years ago, I think we would have been a little bit further along the path towards, you know, those kinds of, you know, the cork finish 750 ml, you know, traditional ciders than where we're sitting today. But I believe we will still get a more sizable audience for that. But, you know, the reality is, you know, most wine sold in this country is $8 to $12 a bottle. It is not $80 a bottle. You know, the craft beer segment took, you know, seemingly forever to cross a 10 share in this business. But that means still 90%, 85-90% of what's consumed in this country in beer is the stuff that was the most popular 30 and 40 years ago, so still that. So we kind of live in a little bit of a bubble, you know, you're in geekdom.
Well, that price point, though, really drives the consumer, too. So that piece that you were talking about last year in your seminar at CiderCon, that branding, what the packaging you're putting out there, and until people really understand the amount of work that goes into an orchard and producing apples... They can't really relate to the price margin sometimes too, so I think that kind of plays into it. And the branding there, you know, people want to try something and they just want to try a little bit. So sometimes that big bottle could be intimidating.
Sure, you know, and that's not to be too self-promoting about this, but that's one of the values of the summit.
Absolutely.
But I think, you know, we will get a, there's a big education component to this, just like there was with beer, and especially with unusual import beers, that will continue to be focused. But I think people that if, you know, you come into this as an entrepreneur, as a brand owner, and you should do something that turns you on. And so if you want to make, you know, traditional cider apple expensive, that's fantastic if that's what your motivation is. But you probably have to model your business maybe more like a Napa winery, a small production winery that needs to get visitors to their tasting room and have a, you know, wine of the month club or something like that, so you can have a viable business on your hands. And
a different kind of business plan. For the different measures, or it's like kind of like a, being a nano brewery. And, you know, here we are, we're talking about three different kinds of drinks, beer, wine, and cider. And I feel like I'm having this conversation more and more where we are always kind of equating cider with those two other markets. And I feel like cider really needs to create its own story and kind of get out of like the comparison to beer and wine in that way, because especially around the craft beer, I think it's too easy to fall into the craft beer, and so then people's palate or the consumer has the same expectation that they've had with craft beer, to really set a unique story for cider, that it's not just, you know, there's not necessarily just the imperial or what the different styles are, but there's this kind of apple. In fact, there's 1,000 different apples that you could have, and maybe that's a story that we need to really start be pushing instead of cider styles.
Yeah, well, I agree with that. I think one of the big, I think that's all part of the educational piece. I think one of the challenges is, and I had this conversation with a well-known artisan cider maker, you know, that what is labeled as cider right now has such an enormous array of, you know, what styles in the bottle. In the jug wine days, even Gallo, Chablis Blanc more or less tasted like white wine. And when you have something labeled Chardonnay, you have some reasonable expectation of roughly what that's going to taste like, just as you do if you buy an imperial stout. You know, maybe we need to be in some sub-categorization like that, so people, because right now, if it's just labeled as cider or hard cider or, you know, whatever has to be called for government regulations, it could be 1,000 different things. And so that's challenging.
Yeah, and those are some of the things that we're kind of moving against, I suppose. But I really believe finding its own story so that we... maybe we'll have this conversation 5 years down the line, which would be really exciting to see if we stop bringing up beer and wine, and we're just talking about cider. Because I think, you know, if we're talking about a wine festival or something like that, they're not necessarily comparing it to beer.
No.
You know, it's just, it's wine. It's a world of wine, and not just a world of wine in the U.S., but the world of wine. And that you're talking about regional areas of the Northwest versus the Northeast, or Michigan, or, you know, Virginia, and that, or Canada, regionally.
I hope and think we'll be on that path.
I hope we're
still kind of in the infancy of the cider category
as
we know it.
It's so hard to believe that, you know, like being 20 years into like ciders, like,
but really,
we were like adolescents.
From broad kind of category awareness, and especially of more artisanal products, where it's, you know, it's more like I brought Aspel in, you know, 2003, but really, even in Washington, there were only a couple of other cider makers then. So we're still, I think, as we know it, you know, not even maybe a decade old right now. So these other categories that we'll say now are nameless, you know, got, you know, 20 and 30 and 40 year ahead starts on what we do. So I you know, we got some growing pains, but I think we'll be having those conversations down the road, not too many years. I hope so.
Thank you so much, Alan, for both participating in this chat on this episode number 75, but also for the work that you do hosting the Cider Summit. It's really helping cider go up all over the map in the U.S., getting that educational piece there. And here's some tips for those of you looking to go to the San Francisco event coming up on April 22nd. You'll be able to choose from nearly 200 ciders. There's going to be cider cocktails. There is a collaboration cider with Finn River and the Cider Summit, and that's going to be a Saison and farm style cider. And Finn River is just a lovely cidery up in Washington. There's also going to be a little bit of a contest, if you will, and it's called the Fruit Cider Challenge. And these are ciders made with guava, apricot, blueberry, blackcurrant, cherry, and passion fruit. So that's, in total, it looks like there's going to be about 13 entries, and anyone attending will be able to vote for their favorite, and the winner will be announced at the conclusion of the event. So that's just the Cider Summit in San Francisco. There'll be a link in the show notes to that particular event. You want to make sure you get your tickets. One thing I know about Cider Summit is it does sell out, so don't hesitate. One of the things that I found really telling about this conversation with Alan is his view of the current cider market and the trends in both the price point for cider in relationship to the current price point for wine, and what it was when a craft beer originally came out. You know, having covered that market for so many years, when a new craft brewery came out, they were definitely selling their bottles for below the average market value that you would see most bottles. So they'd be testing a little bit, getting people kind of like willing to spend the money and make sure it was okay. And one of the qualms I have for new cideries is some of that cider comes out and it isn't really palpable for the market, and it's turned and no one's managing it. And that's a sad thing. And unfortunately, I found that more often than not. So that's a little piece there. He didn't mention that, but I'm going to put my 2 cents in there. And I hope that that is not something that continues, because that really pushes away potential cider drinkers. And the other piece was that he mentioned 5 years back, he thought we'd be in a different place than we are today. Maybe those more artisanal 750 ml bottles were doing better. Now, that's his viewpoint. However, there's a differing viewpoint coming out right now, and that's from the Nielsen Rating, who has been working with the United States Association of Cider Makers and collecting some data. So in the show notes, you're going to be able to actually listen to a webinar that was just produced online by the association, and I'm really excited that they put it up there. There's also a PDF file that you want to follow along, so you could get that link to the recording. Otherwise, you might have a hard time finding it. So make sure you go to the show notes for episode 75. That's what we're on right now. You go down below the show notes with this conversation with Alan. There'll be specific mentions in this chat. That's where you're going to be able to find the link to the recording and hear what they say about the current cider trends. A lot of different voices out there, and you know, for better or for worse, it's different vantages that we're seeing. In all, my vantage is that cider's going up, but it really needs cider festivals like the Cider Summit. It needs that educational piece, and it really requires cider makers to put a product out that's going to have stability and sustainability on the shelf and not be at a price point that consumers can't do. Otherwise, you just kind of keep it in a range that most folks aren't going to be able to do it at, and it's going to, as he said, go for that more high-end kind of winery-style business plan. Pretty interesting stuff. Thanks again, Alan. And also, thank you to Current Cider, which has been part of the Cider Chat Cider Going Up campaign since it started. You too can become part of the Cider Going Up campaign by just going to that page at ciderchat.com and joining, or become a patron yourself via Cider Chat Patreon. All these little ways that help keep this chat thriving. And do know that if you're a patron, you're put into the Cider Swag contest, and a winner will be picked in just 2 or 3 days. Lots of fun out there in Ciderville. And while you're next out and about going to a cider summit or a cidery of your choice, make sure that you try using the Lyft coupon code to get up to sometimes $50 off your first ride, depending on the region where you are. All you need to do is use the code LyftCiderChat for first-time users of that rideshare program. There is a page with the details at ciderchat.com on that Lyft code, LyftCiderChat. Well, now, it's been another great chat with all of you out there in Ciderville. And I hope that, as always, between now and next week, your cup stays full. This is Real Wind Caller signing off for now. Looking forward to seeing you in Ciderville.
Yeehaw!